Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On August 8, 2022, the FBI raided former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home. This unprecedented action was part of an investigation into Trump's possession and mishandling of highly classified documents that he obtained and he kept after he left office. Trump's statement at the time was, "These are dark times for our nation, as my beautiful home, Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida, is currently under siege, raided and occupied by a large group of FBI agents." Trump wrote, "Nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before," he went on. "After working and cooperating with the relevant government agencies, this unannounced raid on my home was not necessary or appropriate." His statement goes on, "Such an assault could only take place in broken third world countries. Sadly, America has now become one of those countries, corrupt at a level not seen before." Trump was able to control the narrative of the FBI raid because the FBI has rules. They have norms. They don't comment on ongoing investigations. And so they weren't able to explain what was going on, their process, what they were after, why Trump was not the target of a hyperpartisan weaponized investigation. There was no witch hunt. And this is just one way that Trump manages to keep the upper hand with the FBI and the Department of Justice. There are lots of ways that he's been able to do that, and it's cataloged, documented, and explained in the new book, Where Tyranny Begins, The Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on American Democracy. It's written by David Rode. He is a 2-time recognized investigative journalist by the Pulitzer Prize. Lots of great books under his name. And David Rode, thank you for coming on The Source.
Thank you, David, for having me.
So all sorts of FBI investigations into Donald Trump, but let's talk about the Mar-a-Lago one because that's, you know, back in the news today. So what happened? Why was Trump able to really control the narrative and get out there that he was the victim?
It's partly what you described. There are strict rules, and they're good rules that prevent the FBI and the Justice Department from talking about a criminal investigation. You know, often people are investigated and never charged with crimes. People's homes are searched, and that's kept secret because, again, they're found to have done no wrongdoing. So it was Trump himself who announced that search. And, you know, say what you want about Trump, even critics would have to admit that he's a very effective communicator. And, you know, the things you were just quoting about the corruption at a level never seen before in the country, and the United States is like a broken third world country, you know, I found that there was an exhaustive effort to slowly and appropriately and finally carry out a search of Mar-a-Lago that was resisted by some FBI officials. But if anything, there was more deference given to Trump than to other people's whose houses are searched.
So we should point out the inaccuracies or lies that were in this statement, that he was not working and cooperating with the relative government agencies. This was not an unannounced raid on his home. And that this is something that could have been handled appropriately had he just turned over the documents when they were requested.
That's correct. And I'll, as we talk over the course of the hour, I want to, you know, talk about Democrats and them being partisan. But it's absolutely true. There was a months-long effort by the National Archives, and then eventually the Justice Department was brought in to get these documents back. And Trump resisted that, and the sort of straw that caused the senior officials in the FBI to overrule lower-level FBI officials who were hesitant to search Mar-a-Lago was that I don't want to nerd out on you and your audience, but there was a visit to Mar-a-Lago several weeks before the search, and Trump's lawyers handed over what they said was the, you know, final, it was a couple dozen classified documents. They swore, "This is it. We've given you everything." The lawyer signed an affidavit saying that was true. And then soon after that, the FBI got surveillance tapes that showed the night before that visit, that the night before or the days before that visit, dozens of boxes were moved and hid in a different place of Mar-a-Lago, and they were still there. And, you know, the promise that these were all the classified documents was not true. And that caused, it was the deputy director of the FBI. There's only one political appointee in the entire FBI. That's the director, Chris Wray, currently. And it was Paul Abate who ordered, and we can talk about this in more detail. It was the person opposing the raid initially was Stephen D'Antuono. He was the head of the Washington field office of the FBI. And he kept saying, let's give Trump more time. We can negotiate with his lawyer. If we go in and search, we're playing into Trump's narrative that the FBI is some deep state actor. And we're playing into his MO was the term D'Antuono. He talked to me for the first time on the record. And it was just fascinating talking to him about his perspective on Mar-a-Lago.
Wray is a Trump appointee. We should point that out.
Yes.
And the narrow focus of your book is about how Trump is using these tactics like he used with the Mar-a-Lago raid in order to basically neuter or defang the FBI when it comes to him and when his efforts to, war on democracy. I mean, two different people could read your book title differently. People who believe Trump's...
That's intentional.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So people thought, the FBI and its war on democracy. Yeah, the deep state is trying to take down Donald Trump, you know, the MAGA folks might think.
Yes, and then liberals will, or Democrats will say it's Trump who's waging war on democracy. And there's more examples of Trump abusing his power and sort of demolishing norms, but... I just worry that our hyperpartisanship is slowly decreasing public trust in important institutions. And I look specifically at the Justice Department and the FBI. And say what you will about Trump, but the first part of the book is the Trump years. And each chapter I found, it describes a systematic tactic he used over and over again. And a key one was how he sort of viewed the court. This is sort of a thing he learned from Roy Cohn, the famous New York lawyer. And it was essentially, there was a liberal critic who came up with this term in Lawfare, a well-known website for, again, nerds on this kind of stuff. But they described the kind of law that Trump and his supporters, or his aides practices, LOL, as in laugh out loud, LOL, nothing matters lawyering. And it's sort of a strategy where you're filing, a court case or taking a legal position. And it's sort of LOL, nothing matters lawyering. It's the goal is, can we kind of own the libs? Can we make some claim in our filing that frustrates the libs, that number two gets a lot of publicity? And then for sort of lower level people in the Trump administration, the third key thing is, does this get Donald Trump's attention? Does he like it? Go ahead.
I got to take this break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this. And also want to let everyone know that the phone lines are open. You can call in with your questions and comments about Donald Trump and about how he manipulated, co-opted, bullied, silenced the FBI, the Department of Justice. Did he get away with crimes because of norms that we have in society, or because we don't want to unravel our democracy with this one-upmanship? What's happening? 833-877-8255. The source continues after this.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies with me on the line, David Rode. His new book is Where Tyranny Begins, The Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy. He's talking about Donald Trump and others who are able to beat down the FBI because of FBI's concerns about norms and how they look and their public image. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Now, I'm going to play a clip for you, David. This is like right after the Mar-a-Lago raid, and this is a CNN reporter, Drew Griffin. He confronts a Florida Republican congressional candidate, Anthony Sabatini, about his calls to defund the FBI. And also, there are a lot of calls at the time for violence against the FBI and Merrick Garland at the time, right after the search of the Mar-a-Lago.
In Florida,
how's it going?
Ultra-mega Republican, Florida State Representative Anthony Sabatini is trying to take right-wing outrage one step further.
If it was up to me, I would totally defund the FBI.
I'm Anthony Sabatini.
He's running for Congress in Florida's 7th District and has been making the rounds on far-right media after writing a tweet saying sever all ties with DOJ immediately, and any FBI agent conducting law enforcement functions outside the purview of our state should be arrested upon sight.
Common sense.
Because?
Well, because what they're doing is unlawful. It's time to actually start protecting the rights of Floridians under the 10th Amendment and push back against a lawless federal government.
Right now, today, in Florida, FBI agents are chasing down bank robbers, criminals,
yeah.
attacking cyber crime in this state,
gotcha.
Helping local law enforcement.
Yeah.
You don't think there's any value in that?
It's an illogical argument. The FBI at this point is totally useless. We need to defund it and let red states.
You have no idea what the value of the FBI is.
Yes, I do.
Is a former president just above the law no matter what?
The FBI is not above the law.
If I'm saying they followed the law, which they did, to enter into that home, should that just not be allowed? The president, the former president, is above the law.
He's a political target. He's being harassed by a lawless,
you think he's
rogue
above the law?
Agency.
He's not, it's not a lawless
they
agency.
They spied on him. They have no respect for
you
him.
Have no idea.
They hate the conservatives. They hate the Republicans.
Now, to close the loop on this, we'll get to your comment, David. So Drew Griffin, that CNN reporter, investigative reporter, he died 4 months later. He was battling cancer at that time. And also that candidate Anthony Sabatini, he dropped out of the race after Trump endorsed his primary opponent. But get your reaction to that exchange.
It's just very dangerous. All of it is, most of it is false. But I just look, the title of the book, you know, is based on a John Locke quote from 1689, where law ends, tyranny begins. And what, you know, the candidate there was expressing was this fear that when it is dangerous, that tyranny begins often when, you know, a political leader uses law enforcement agencies and the courts to unfairly investigate and smear and even jail their opponents. But none of that was true in Mar-a-Lago. What Drew Griffin said was correct. This was, they had waited months to make this search. They had gone to a judge and gotten a search warrant. They had given Trump more than, you know, there are low-level people who take classified documents to their homes, just government workers, and they are immediately charged and their homes are immediately searched. So all of that does not fit the findings of my book. And I wrote a previous book about, called In Deep, about, you know, is there a deep state? And I, look, the FBI is not perfect. There were mistakes made, unquestionably, but I've never found any evidence of some FBI deep state plot to undermine Trump or any other president. There were terrible abuses, you know, decades ago under J. Edgar Hoover, but a raft of reforms was made after Watergate. And so it's just a very, the current state of, I think, both on the left and the right, it's more concerning on the right, the talk of violence, but there's just a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there.
So what about the left? What are you saying about the left? I mean, if the left is calling for, we want the law enforced, is that hyper-partisanship?
It's a good, fair question. My example of that, and look, there are many more examples of Trump doing this from the left. But my example of that, and it's a similar thing in that a special counsel was appointed by Merrick Garland to investigate Joe Biden's mishandling of classified documents. Joe Biden kept a much smaller number of classified documents in storage in his house. And so, and listeners might remember this, but Robert Hur was that special counsel. He wrote in his report that he decided in part not to try Biden because a jury, according to Hur, would see Biden as a well-meaning older man with a memory.
So you know, I have a clip for that. And so I'm gonna give it up. This is from PBS NewsHour. Let's give a listen.
Thank you.
All right. Are we able to get that? Just 1 second.
What my report reflects is my judgment that based on the evidence, I would not be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that intent element had.
Hur's report said making that case would be difficult because the president, quote, would likely present himself to a jury, as he did during our interview of him, as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory.
My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president.
According to the transcript of the president's five-hour interview with the special counsel last year, Biden at times spoke in great detail about decades-old events, but in other cases struggled to recall dates, like when he left the vice presidency or when his son died.
How in the hell dare he raise that?
Democrats accused Hur of partisanship by inserting what they described as inflammatory language about the president's age and memory.
You chose a general pejorative reference to the president. You understood when you made that decision, didn't you, Mr. Hur, that you would ignite a political firestorm with that language, didn't you?
Congressman, politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps.
But you understood nevertheless, didn't you, Mr. Hur? Mr. Hur, you cannot tell me you're so naive as to think your words would not have created a political firestorm. You understood that, didn't you?
So the question is, was that comment even appropriate? Was it necessary? Do special investigators typically write about the character or the characteristics of the person that they're investigating in that way?
Yes, he's trying to explain why he didn't bring the charge. And, you know, Adam Schiff there is criticizing Hur. Adam Schiff later called for for Biden to drop out of the race because, as Hur stated factually, you know, he would be perceived as a well-meaning older man, elderly man with a poor memory. And I cite this example just because, again, there's many more examples of Trump doing this and much broader lies and more extreme rhetoric. But Hur was trying to produce a factual report. Biden had kept a small number of, you know, classified documents for longer than he should have, and it could have been charged with it. And he's trying to explain why he didn't bring the charge. So, you know, when the American people watched the Biden-Trump debate, I think there was a consensus. And again, Adam Schiff agrees with this, that the president has a memory issue. And so it was just unusual, in my view, for Democrats to so, you know, aggressively attack an independent investigator, a special counsel, and accuse him of being some kind of Republican plant. And it's what you talked about. Like, I get the frustration among Democrats as Trump does more extreme things. You talked earlier about, Dave, you know, how do we not unravel our democracy with one-upsmanship? Again, the vast majority of the examples are much more on Trump's side, but great reporting by my colleague Ken Delanian here at NBC. He was able to sort of get a sense of that transcript and see that, you know, there were real memory issues that Hur saw and experienced firsthand when he interviewed Biden.
And so the issue has been like presidential immunity, and the Supreme Court has weighed in on that. And they said, well, in official acts, yes, he has immunity. And now, of course, you know, with a new indictment that came down yesterday, trying to fix indicting Donald Trump, saying that his acts were not official, they were him as a candidate. In fact, though, if we have an FBI and a Justice Department that is afraid or reluctant, or they're more concerned about their public image, then so they won't indict, and they won't investigate, and they won't pursue crimes by a president, then basically he is immune.
You're absolutely right. So you're citing two very important things. One is just an atmosphere that leads FBI agents, and this is what happened in the Mar-a-Lago case. Political, you know, cases like this, high stakes ones, you know, I think are still seen inside the FBI's as losers, as lose-lose situations, as career enders. And people who are involved in this debate about when and how to search Mar-a-Lago, you know, they felt they were stepping over the bodies of former colleagues who had worked on the Trump-Russia investigation, who had been publicly attacked and pilloried, and, you know, and even Justice Department officials, you know, didn't enjoy having this case. You know, people think they might, you know, but they did not, because people know the dangers of doing this and how it can sort of destroy their careers. And then the Supreme Court ruling was unprecedented. It created a whole new immunity for presidents to say anything they want to an attorney general, and it's legal. A former Justice Department official who worked under Trump and left, you know, he was shocked by that decision. It's legal now for a president to call up his attorney general and say, let's go burglarize the Democratic National Committee headquarters. And that conversation is absolutely immune. It cannot be used as evidence of a criminal act or conspiracy. So it's, you know, again, these are historic times, but that was a very sweeping ruling.
And so does that mean that so Democrats will follow the norms, and therefore, and people like Trump, this is Trump, I don't want to call him a Republican, because there have been many, many Republicans that have followed the norms. So set him in a class by himself, but he won't. So basically we're playing by two set of rules.
It's true. And the book, you know, jumping around a bit, but, you know, Bill Barr, there's a belief, and I think this had a role in the immunity ruling. There's a belief among conservatives, and Bill Barr gave a speech about this when he was attorney general, that the Watergate reforms went too far and they weakened the presidency too much, that these independent counsels had too much power and could just cripple a presidency for years. And some of that, I think, is what led the conservative justices to come out with this immunity ruling. And the belief there from, you know, Barr is that every 4 years, the voters will hold a president and an attorney general accountable and vote them out of office if they're using the DOJ to, you know, prosecute their political enemies and go easy on their political friends. To Bill Barr's credit, and I'm trying to be, and I am, like, I'm a reporter, I'm fact-based, I'm nonpartisan, and that's my job. But so Bill Barr did that in the end. He did not go along with Trump's claim that the 2020 election was stolen. You know, Justice Department investigators looked at the claims and found them not to be true. Dozens of federal judges across the country, some even appointed by Trump, rejected the 2020 claims. And so did the Supreme Court. You know, but that just brings us back to how sort of dangerous it is to not accept election results. And again, my fear is that as the public, as there's just sort of more and more charges, Trump does it the most, that to discredit institutions, you know, the public doesn't trust our institutions. And the miracle of American democracy is a peaceful election and the peaceful transfer of power. And, you know, we will see what happens this November. But we've entered dangerous territory.
Right. And we'll continue talking about how using the Justice Department, using the courts in order to bolster democracy could actually have the reverse effect, and it really should be up to the voters. And here we are. We got guess what? We got an election coming up here pretty soon. So let's take a break here. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're talking about the book Where Tyranny Begins with author David Rode. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with David Rode. He's been recognized with the Pulitzer Prize twice. His new book is Where Tyranny Begins, The Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy. And we're talking about Donald Trump and how he played the FBI and the Department of Justice like a fiddle. When he was president, he was able to quash investigations, and he was also able to, as a candidate for president, in order to dance around them as they investigated him. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Jerry on the phones. And Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask Mr. Rose about a couple of items of Trump's presidency. One has to do with his relationship with Kim Jong-il from North Korea. He had a chance to talk to this man about the relationship between North Korea and America and maybe talk about cutting out this declaration of war that still exists. Instead, Trump, you know, kind of demanded that he dump his nuclear program, and that put it completely off. And another thing, during the Trump administration, he raised the debt limit on the national debt. At the same time, he gave tax breaks to the most rich people in America. And the third item was about cutting off the applications for immigration in southern Mexico. And I think this was the reason why, since they couldn't apply for citizenship anymore, they just en masse migrated to the Texas border. Any comments that Mr. Rose could make about this, I'd appreciate.
Well, thank you for that, Jerry. And so, David Rode, that's not in the scope of your book. You're not really talking about these types of policy decisions that Donald Trump made. But I don't know if you want to comment that or not. We can move on.
I think they're interesting because they both, again, show how aggressively Trump operated outside the norms of even politics. And I think he used the same approach when it came to the Justice Department and the FBI. And then if you just deny wrongdoing or dismiss criticism, it works. At least it works for him.
So, you know, there was this idea that that Donald Trump had colluded with Russia. Let's talk about, violating the norms. That's not something that a person running for president would actually do, candidate for president. You know, we had the FBI open up a Crossfire Hurricane investigation into Russia's interference in July of 2016. They had a special focus on looking at links between Trump associates and Russian officials and spies. We had the Mueller investigation, report on the investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election was released in 2019. And it's still kind of getting different reads over, like, what was in that report. You know, did it exonerate Trump, or did it actually show that there was Russian interference and there was some level of collusion or coordination with the Trump campaign?
It definitely showed Russian interference, unquestionably, a systematic effort to boost Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. It did not find enough evidence, and this gets into all these legalisms, you know, I think to bring a case against Trump, is what Robert Mueller decided, to try to convict him or his aides for coordinating with Russia. And then the big debate was, did he obstruct justice? And a key moment in all this, and it's another scene in the book, is Bill Barr, you know, releases the full report with some intelligence information redacted, but he holds a press conference. And that was very unusual because, again, attorneys general since Watergate were trying to be different than John Mitchell, Nixon's attorney general, who went to prison, used his office as attorney general to, you know, investigate groups that Nixon considered enemies, Vietnam War protesters, black nationalists, and also use the attorney general's office to investigate people and leaking embarrassing information about Nixon. And so Barr gets up and holds this press conference and basically exonerates Trump. He frames the report saying that there was, you know, no coordination, no collusion, and no other wrongdoing. After he releases it, there's a dozen examples of improper behavior that could be seen as trying to obstruct the investigation. And it's interesting. One of the folks I talked to in the book is named Ed O'Callaghan. He helped Rod Rosenstein oversee the Mueller report. And I heard from people who worked on the Mueller investigation that Rod Rosenstein, a career DOJ guy, did let Mueller's team do their work, that Trump made all these public complaints. He pressured Rod Rosenstein. He pressured Jeff Sessions. But Mueller was able to carry out their work. But Ed O'Callaghan admitted to me that as he was standing there, it's a picture in the book, it's a bar, and then behind him these sort of stone-faced, they always do this, the Justice Department, the officials standing behind the Attorney General look, they don't smile, they don't frown, they try to look very sort of bland. And Ed O'Callaghan admitted to me that as he was listening to Barr speak, he thought the press conference was a mistake. He felt that the Mueller report and investigation was proper and like a public service to try to investigate these questions, but that Barr went too far when he gave that report. Barr would not really talk to me in detail for this book, but again, he stated publicly that he just felt there shouldn't have ever been an investigation. There was no question that Trump was potentially colluding. So again, he saw the whole Mueller appointment as a way to cripple Trump's presidency unfairly. I saw it as a public service. And whether it's Robert Hur coming to his, you know, conclusions about whether to prosecute or not, or Robert Mueller, or Jack Smith, like, I think we're better off, or I hope we can think that these special counsels are presenting the facts as fairly as they can, and not peddling secret, having sort of secret political agendas. I don't think Hur did that. I don't think Mueller did that. And we'll see what happens with Smith.
So the idea is that we should leave much of this to the voters. The voters should decide who is going to be punished and who should remain in office, who should be elected. But the problem is that if you have people in office who are going to abuse their law enforcement agencies to investigate and prosecute their political opponents, then the voters really don't get a fair shot at who they want to elect. There's roles for both sides.
I agree, and I think I want to see more divisions of power in the country. I want three healthy and strong branches of government, you know, the president, Congress, and the judiciary. Special counsels their investigations have gone on too long. Bill Clinton was deeply frustrated by Whitewater. They've been reformed. There's limits now in the special counsels, but I like special counsels. I like, you know, when a special counsel was appointed to investigate Hunter Biden, it was, you know, the support was very high, around 70%, I believe, in opinion polls. So I think American democracy needs nonpartisan public servants. We need nonpartisan election workers who will accurately count votes. We need nonpartisan police and judges who will enforce the law the same, you know, against all people. We need nonpartisan public health officials. We need nonpartisan journalists that are just presenting some facts, because if we can't agree on the basic facts, such as who won the election, that, to me, again, sets us down a dangerous path, and I worry about political violence.
So Bill Barr, it's been reported, was able to basically put a stop to an investigation on if Trump received $10 million in cash from Egypt as he was going into the final days before the 2016 presidential election, that he, this money would gave him an infusion to do some buy some ads and to do some things. And there was an investigation into whether or not there was this money that came from Egypt or not, and then Bill Barr prevented the investigators from getting to the bank records to that they could make a clearer determination. It could be seen that Bill Barr interfered with this investigation in order to protect Trump.
He very well may have. I didn't, to be honest. I think some of that became public after I finished the book. But I guess I'm a mainstream journalist and maybe too much of an institutionalist. I guess I would be curious if you know, I would ask Merrick Garland, did he look into that case? It's a possibility that a statute of limitations.
No, he didn't. And so that's another criticism from Merrick Garland we can get into, you know, because Democrats are now salivating at the idea of getting a more, you know, more fuerte, you know, attorney general if Kamala Harris was able to win.
I just, I've talked to people around Garland and I, you know, he's a real believer in the post-Watergate model of an apolitical attorney general. And I think if there was powerfully clear evidence that Donald Trump improperly got $10 million from the Egyptian government, it would be investigated by Merrick Garland's Justice Department. The Democrats, when they had control of Congress, would have, you know, launched an investigation and subpoenaed records. And I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just pointing out that and it should be investigated, and journalists should look at it also. But a lot of time has gone by since Democrats are in power, and there isn't a, you know, I don't see a everyone from House Democrats, okay. You know what I mean.
All right, not Saved by the Bell. We're going to take a break here. The number is 833-877-8255. The source continues. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, Where Tyranny Begins reveals the strategies that Trump systematically employed within his relentless push to turn the Justice Department and the FBI into his personal political weapons. While Trump's behavior in office may have seemed erratic, Rhodes shows how he methodically used the same techniques over and over again to silence the DOJ and the FBI officials and to bend them to his will. That's part of your, publicity write up about your book, David. It's not, there's no both sides-erism right there. It wasn't like, you know, the Democrats do it too. You know, you lay it out that this is Donald Trump, working the levers to turn the FBI into his political machine.
Look, it's true. And I talked about this a little earlier. Each of the chapters in the Trump part of the book, I talked about LOL, nothing matters lawyering earlier about how to use the court system to kind of get your messaging out. But, you know, chapter two, demolish norms. Chapter three, terminate and remove. Chapter four, investigate the investigators. Chapter five, disparage and discredit. Chapter six, shield and protect. And chapter seven, stoke conspiracy theories. And these are the tactics that Trump used over and over again. I agree. He did this far more than Democrats ever did. I guess, and it's a lot of this was talking to Justice Department and FBI officials, but there's just a sense that that some people on the it's that the criminal justice system, it's a contradictory situation where if Trump has broken the law, you know, he should be prosecuted. I guess that it's a lot more complicated to prosecute a former president than I think many people expected. It can infuriate people and in that he should be quickly prosecuted and why has it taken so long. But it's not like a conviction, like the New York case, the hush money case, will immediately discredit Donald Trump. And Jamie Raskin, of all people, a firebrand Democrat, House member from Maryland, said it's really important to also to win the political battle, was the way he put it in one interview I had with him, to sort of continue the political fight. And Justice Department officials, and again, this might frustrate people, they feel like that the court system isn't the place. It's a clunky, slow place where you can have lots of delays, but it's not an effective or quick way to resolve our political differences. I know that's not a satisfying answer for people.
Well, you know, I am hearing you, and I'm thinking about how you've covered, what, two civil wars?
Yes.
You were held captive by the Taliban for 6 months, and you escaped. You have a view of the world. You see how when countries tear themselves apart.
It's conspiracy theories. And each side in the war thinks they're the, you know, the righteous side, excuse me, who's defending their way of life, their family, their democratic system against, you know, this evil other side that's trying to destroy it. And it does impact my my view. And it's how effective that the issue with human nature, I think there's, you know, some people that are sadistic who know they're doing something wrong and maybe enjoy it. But what I found in and even in my time in captivity with the Taliban, I was held by the Bosnian Serbs briefly when I covered Bosnia, was that the real danger is the human ability to rationalize, that how humans sort of convince themselves that they are acting in a just way and they kind of have to resort to violence. The other side is forcing them to do it. And I, again, so all this rhetoric, lock him up, lock her up. And you know, you can argue he deserves it. You know, we have to see. Is dangerous. And then, and I'll stop, but I wish there had been trials for Trump. There's a chance he would be acquitted. Our congressional investigations have kind of become seen as just, again, partisan sort of showmanship. And I think a trial, I covered trials in New York for a couple of years, the New York Times, like they are an extraordinary fact-finding exercise where people are forced to testify under oath or face perjury charges. And so you could have had Rudy Giuliani and Mike Pence and all these various people talking about Trump's actions around January 6th and let the public decide. I mean, a jury will make a decision, but so you can't rush these trials, but it was a disappointment, obviously, for Democrats that there will be no January 6th trial before the election, just to give the electorate facts. And there is a narrow chance that, particularly the people said in a Florida jury, that he could be acquitted on the classified documents case. And if you look at the New York case, I mean, it he was convicted, but it didn't move. It actually, all the indictments helped Trump gain support and really dominate the Republican primary. So again, the prosecuting an opponent, even if they arguably deserve it, isn't a silver bullet.
A lot of people look at Trump and what we're going through and the demolishing of these norms and the corruption of these institutions, and they're saying, why is this happening? And I wonder, why hasn't this happened before? Why didn't other presidents, why weren't they able to do this? They probably would have liked to if they could have been able to, I guess. Certainly Nixon, you know, he wouldn't like to have resigned. So why do you think it's happening? Why didn't this happen before? Do you think that there were some safeguards in place before that are no longer there?
I think our hyper-partisanship has made it easier for a president to gut out, you know, criticism and Trump.
But isn't the hyper-partisanship a symptom of where we are? This is not happening because of the hyper-partisanship. The hyper-partisanship is happening because of Trump.
Yes. I think he's exacerbating a long-term trend. And look, no president since Nixon dared do what Trump did, attack an independent special counsel, you know, attack the FBI publicly, because they all thought it would be so unpopular that they would be eventually forced to resign. The Republican Party turned against Nixon. Republicans did not turn against Trump. And so that's what I mean about the depth of the partisanship. And he demolished these norms that no president, Republican or Democrat, dared to flout for 50 years since Nixon. It's almost helped him with his base. And so we're just in dangerous territory because the divisions, the almost different realities that people have continue to exist. And our court system doesn't seem able to have trials and come up with verdicts or have findings that people will agree on.
Let's go to a caller. We have Nancy on the line. Nancy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just so frustrated because I feel like Merrick Garland has just been so careful, and his reticence is actually, to me, is undermining the rule of law. It's not, I don't want him to politicize the Justice Department. I just want him to uphold the law. And I feel that what he's doing is setting a really bad example I know that, you know, my children are feeling like, what's the point? You know, nothing's going to happen anyway. And it's not that I want Trump to go to jail because he's Trump. I want him to be held up to account so this doesn't happen again.
Nancy, thank you for your call. David Rode.
It's a great question, and people are frustrated. There's a chapter about the Garland years that's called the lost year. And it is that he moved too slowly in the first year. He was very careful. He thought that the best way he could regain the trust of the public was by being, you know, hyper fair. He lost time doing that. He did eventually appoint Jack Smith. Jack Smith brought indictments, but this immunity ruling from the Supreme Court derailed the January 6th trial that I think could have happened this summer. And it was a surprise to Justice Department officials. They never thought it would be so sweeping. It's very vaguely worded. So, you know, you just had Jack Smith filing the new indictments yesterday, but the definition of an official act, you know, which is allowed versus a personal act, is so vaguely described in the Supreme Court immunity ruling that it's going to go back to the Supreme Court. So you did have judges, you know, hand Trump a major victory with that immunity ruling. So I understand the frustration. And then here's just a little contradiction, or just Garland as a person. He exists in some ways as a person because of the rule of law in the United States and the upholding of it. His grandmother was able to escape Europe and escape the Holocaust and come to the U.S. That eventually leads to, you know, the birth of Merrick Garland. And he passionately believes, I've talked to his aides about this, about the importance of upholding the rule of law. And I argue, you know, people have talked to him about how the Justice Department has its hand tied behind the back when Garland won't go out and sort of forcibly respond to these false claims by Trump. He does it sometimes, but, you know, not that aggressively. And Garland swears, he's told aides this, that he will never allow the Justice Department to sort of cross that line and act politically. He said the most important thing is upholding the rule of law in a nonpartisan way. And Garland has told aides, we would not want to become a political actor. That is the end of the rule of law. And I know that's frustrating. Yeah. And, you know, maybe the...
Well, we have this election. People will be voting. they read your book, hear about your book, read the reviews about your book, listen to programs like this one, and they go vote.
And again, folks that are frustrated I'm sure there's people who are frustrated from both sides listening to us, but go vote. Go peacefully engage in politics. Go persuade your neighbor to, you know, support the cause. But have faith that there is not, you know, some conspiracy by the Justice Department or the FBI or election clerks, you know, to engage in massive fraud in this election. Again, there was a conservative state Supreme Court justice.
We're totally out of time, David, so yeah. I'm really sorry about that. I'm sorry I had to cut you off. I can talk to you for hours. David Rode, his book is Where Tyranny Begins, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy. Thank you so much. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
Has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.